Thank you so much, President Lambert. And thank you, my fellow degree holders here, Joe Melvin and Mike Weaver. Now, the three of us, you realize, get the first law degrees from Elon School of Law. And we didn't have to go to school 3 years to do it. So eat your hearts out, you law students. Now, President Lambert and Dean Davis and faculty and students and friends of Elon University, it is an enormous honor for me to be here with you today at this fall convocation. Now, a convocation speech is a difficult assignment. The speaker is given no topic and is expected to inspire all the students with a stirring speech about nothing at all. Now, that's why so many lawyers are asked to be public speakers. They're in the habit of talking extensively, even when they have nothing to say. Now, in this case, the university asked not only a lawyer, but an elderly judge to be the convocation speaker. I was born in the state of Texas. In Texas, they say that an old judge is like an old shoe. Everything is all worn out except the tongue. The chief function of a convocation speaker, of course, is to be brief. Lord Canning was once asked by a preacher how he enjoyed his sermon. Canning replied, "You were brief." "Ah," said the preacher, "I always like to avoid being tedious." Canning thought for a moment, and then he said, "You were also tedious." So there's no absolute guarantee of success, but I'll do my best. I want to open my remarks today with an excerpt of a poem by Will Allam Drongul called The Bridge Builder. The poem begins with an old man who confronts a big canyon chasm at twilight. And finding the crossing to be very difficult, the old man successfully crosses it but decides to build a bridge to cross the divide. The poem says, "Old man," said a fellow pilgrim near, "you're wasting strength with building here. Your journey will end with the ending day. You never again must pass this way. You've crossed the chasm deep and wide. Why build you the bridge at the eventide?" The builder lifted his old gray head. "Good friend, in the path I've come," he said, "there follows after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. This chasm that has been naught to me, to that fair-haired youth, may a pitfall be. He too must cross in the twilight dim. Good friend, I'm building the bridge for him." It's quite fitting that we take a few moments this morning to think about building bridges. After all, that's the task upon which Elon University, its professors, and of course, its students are embarked. This doesn't mean you have to put on your hard hats and get ready to undertake a construction project, although I understand that the students here have built a house every year under Habitat for Humanity, so you know how to do that. But the bridges I'm discussing today are of the metaphorical variety. Of course, Elon University itself functions as a bridge, as it helps its undergraduate students in transitioning from the end of adolescence to the beginning of adulthood. Similarly, Elon's graduate schools, such as the new law school, serve as a bridge for turning individuals with general backgrounds into professionals. And I would be remiss if I didn't add here that This, of course, is the first year that this wonderful university will begin training lawyers. And later today, I will play a small role in dedicating the Elon University School of Law. But the bridges that I want to mention today are the ones created by careers in public service. Ours is a nation built on pride and sacrifice and commitment to shared values, on a willingness of our citizens to give of their time and their energy for the good of the whole. Perhaps some of you will yourselves go on to spending part or all of your lives in public service. Indeed, for all the good that can be done by citizens who volunteer or become involved in political affairs in other ways, the simple truth is that our nation needs hardworking, innovative, dedicated people to spend their working lives, or at least part of them, to the operation and improvement of our nation. We are the nation that we are today because those bridge builders of the past gave of themselves in ways that really mattered. My own career in public service was born of necessity. After graduating near the top of my law school class at Stanford, I could not get a job as a lawyer in the private sector. I couldn't even get an interview because they didn't recruit or hire women. I did receive one contingent offer of employment as a legal secretary, but that isn't what I wanted to do. But the gender barrier that blocked me out of the private sector was more easily hurdled in the public sector, and my first job was as a deputy county attorney in San Mateo County, California. Although brought to that position by something short of choice, I realized very soon what a wonderful path I had taken. I had a better time at my job in that office than my classmates who had opted for private practice. Life as a public servant was more interesting, the work was more challenging, and I had more responsibility than did my classmates. The encouragement and guidance from good mentors there was genuine, and the opportunities for me to take initiative and see results were more frequent. Ultimately, this initial foray into the area of public service led me to the privilege of serving later as an assistant attorney general in my state of Arizona, as a state senator there, as a state judge, and ultimately on the Supreme Court. And at every step of the way, I felt the pride of doing something right for a reason that was good. And it was that joy of building bridges. To be sure, the work of bridge building can be as taxing as it is rewarding. The efforts sometimes call for sacrifice, sometimes emotional, sometimes financial, sometimes personal. The people who opt for a life in public service certainly open themselves up to public review. 52 years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States held that the old segregationist doctrine of separate but equal was unconstitutional as applied to public school children. It struck down the legal fiction that children of different races received equal protection of the law, even though they were forced to attend separate schools. That opinion would have been impossible had it not been for a number of intermediate decisions that paved the way, stones paving the bridge to equality, you might say. And the first step towards that Brown decision actually came 60 years earlier, just as the court first endorsed the doctrine of separate but equal in the case of Plessy versus Ferguson. In Louisiana, at that time, white and black train passengers were separated by law. But Mr. Plessy defied the law by refusing to move from a white rail car to a colored rail car. He claimed that Louisiana's law violated his rights under the 13th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution, which guaranteed citizens equal protection under law. Unfortunately for Plessy, the Supreme Court of the United States in that time upheld his conviction in an opinion full of sentiments that seem foreign to our ears today. It held that laws requiring the separation of the races do not necessarily imply the inferiority of either race to the other, and were normally within the power of the states to enact. As examples, the court offered state laws segregating schools, and so on. The court thought such laws were quite permissible under the Constitution, that the legal separation of the races was not a problem because it had nothing to do with political or legal equality. If any such law created a badge of inferiority for African Americans, it was, and I quote from the opinion, solely because the colored race chose to put that construction upon it. The only dissent in the Plessy case came from Justice John Marshall Harlan. Although it was only one of a number of dissents he wrote over the years, it's the most famous, and justly so. Justice Harlan first said what everyone knew. The Louisiana law was not really meant to exclude white people from black railroad cars. It was meant to exclude blacks from white railroad cars. That meant that the law obstructed the civil rights of blacks and whites to travel together with their consent. Once he established that, Justice Harlan found the case easy to decide. This is what he said. In view of the Constitution, in the eye of the law, there is in this country no superior dominant ruling class of citizens. There is no caste here. Our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. In respect of civil rights, all citizens are equal before the law. The humblest is the peer of the most powerful. The law regards man as man and takes no account of his surroundings or his color when his civil rights are as guaranteed by the supreme law of the land are involved. Justice Harlan predicted that in time, Plessy versus Ferguson would turn out to be as pernicious as the old Dred Scott case. And of course, history has proven him correct on this point. Justice Harlan's famous dissent in Plessy was, of course, only the first of a number of important steps toward the decision in Brown versus Board of Education. But Justice Harlan put the first stone in that bridge that all of us in this nation would eventually cross. The bridge from a nation plagued by the inequity of Jim Crow laws and segregated schools to the one in which we now live. Justice Harlan must have known that racial segregation might outlive him, but he also knew that the struggle would continue. His dissent served the highest ideal of public service. It inspired those who came after him to dedicate their own lives to the service of others. Before Brown, Justice Harlan's words stood as a beacon of hope to my late colleague Thurgood Marshall, as he told me several times, and to countless others who struggled for racial equality under the law. After Justice Harlan passed away, then Chief Justice Fred Vinson continued the tradition of public service. Although Chief Justice Vinson was not a civil rights revolutionary, his cautious and incremental approach to the law also helped build the bridge to Brown. In 1950, Chief Justice Vinson wrote two interesting opinions for the court that represented really the last gasp of the Plessy era. McLaurin versus Oklahoma State Regents was a case that involved six African-American students who had been admitted to a formerly all-white institution, but they were required to sit separately from the white students in classrooms and in libraries and cafeterias. Chief Justice Vinson wrote that setting African-American students apart in that way handicapped their pursuit of an effective graduate education. He rejected as irrelevant the argument that white students might refuse to associate with black students even without official segregation. To him, there was a constitutional difference between state-enforced and voluntary segregation. The other case was Sweat versus Painter. In that case, the University of Texas claimed that it gave an African-American man an equal education by creating a new law school for him in a Houston basement as a counterpart to its all-white law school in Austin, Texas. Cutting through the rhetoric, Chief Justice Vinson focused on the practical differences between the two schools, finding it difficult to believe that one who had a free choice between these law schools would consider the question close. To him, Heman Sweat was entitled to the rich traditions and prestige of the Austin campus, not the false equality of a Houston basement. Now, while neither the Sweat nor McLaurin cases directly addressed the validity of the separate but equal regime, Chief Justice Vinson's opinions all but completed the bridge that Justice Harlan had begun building in his Plessy dissent. And after his victories in those two cases, the lawyer for the petitioners, Thurgood Marshall, wrote to his NAACP supporters that Sweat and McLaurin cases had gutted the Plessy decision and the end was in sight. So I think the lives of Justice Harlan and Chief Justice Vinson illustrate the sacrifice that's sometimes part of public service, and they show that we cannot expect that our efforts will meet with immediate success, but the ever-present understanding that you are part of something bigger than yourself, and that your efforts are paving the way for those who follow, can make a life in public service worth the bumps along the way. Justice Harlan died before he saw his words become law, but if he hadn't taken up his pen against injustice, I think our nation would have taken a slower path to equality. And while it surprised me to learn that Chief Justice Vinson died quite a poor man, he left behind a gift worth more than any gold, a bridge to freedom and equality under law. And now today we are here with the beginning of a new law school at this university, where the hopes and ideas of Justice Harlan and Chief Justice Vinson are certainly vindicated and well adapted. And if we focus our energies on sharing ideas, on finding solutions, and on using what is right with America to remedy what's wrong with it, we can make a difference in this country. Our nation needs bridges, and bridges are built only by those like Justice Harlan or Chief Justice Vinson, who look to the future and dedicate themselves to helping others. And while I've concentrated my remarks today on the bridges built by the legal world, since we're here to celebrate a new law school, my comments are not, of course, limited to the law. All of you students, undergraduate and otherwise, as you embark on your studies this year, whatever your field of choice, I hope you will commit yourselves to being bridge builders. Every generation builds on the work of the generation that preceded it and attempts to improve the world for the generations that follow. The work is there to be done. Our nation needs your help. And those who cross those bridges will thank you. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for letting me be with you today and for the privilege of now claiming alumna status at your university. Thank you.